I was trying to deal this week with what I consider to be the basic symbols and the basic principles of American life, that is, of the American nation as a people. And we have been thinking about freedom or liberty, equality, and fraternity. And today I wanted to talk about the meaning of freedom, equality, and fraternity under God. Some people talk of the American nation as having what they call a civic religion or a civil religion. And when they speak that way, they go to the language of the politicians, and frequently they go to Lincoln as one who represents the civil religion. And it's interesting in that connection that in thinking about the civil religion and in thinking about the kind of statements that are made, one finds references to God. That is, the politicians, of course, are always using it in their inaugurals. And sometimes one thinks it doesn't amount to very much, and it's kind of thrown in as a kind of sop. But nevertheless, it's there. In Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, for example, he concludes it with the notion that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And the question is, what is the meaning of that under God? I'm not trying to ask what the meaning is for Lincoln. I'm really trying to ask what the meaning is for us when we think about freedom, equality, and fraternity. We have noticed over this week that the notion of freedom is a very rich notion, and that ordinarily we think of freedom, certainly in the political realm, as freedom from external restraint. And we think of it mostly in terms of rights to do what we want to do, freedom of speech, freedom from interference with our speech, freedom of assembly, freedom from interference with assembly, freedom from religion, freedom from interference with our religion. So the emphasis is put upon our freedom to do what we will to do, what I call self-initiation. So freedom then becomes choice. We also saw how freedom is freedom from our internal compulsions. That is, it's freedom of the self to be itself, not to be determined by its history, by its internal developments, which in a sense tie it up and make it unfree to deal with life as it is, to look at life in its reality, but which distort life for reasons that serve the self in some way, a self which is not free to look at life as it is. And so we think of freedom as freedom from these internal compulsions. And then we think of freedom as limitation by consent. So we are free if we have consented to our own limitations. And there's a sense in which that's at the heart of our democracy. We believe in law and the order that is established by law and the determination of our lives by law, but we really think that that law that limits us must be consented to. So freedom is not simply freedom from external interference, but it's freedom in such a, or it's freedom that involves our consent to any external interference with our choice. And then finally, I suggested that freedom in the great classical Greek tradition that's permeated much of the West, more in the Germanic tradition, less in the French and English, and hence in the American tradition, is freedom that involves the truth or the good, so that one is really free in this tradition, and they'll always have that real. You can read the literature, and it's interesting to find how as soon as people begin to talk about real freedom, you know you're in a different world. You're just in a different world of understanding. For we tend to talk about freedom as if we knew what freedom was. And and in this tradition, you'll talk about real versus unreal freedom. So that in this, the classical Greek tradition, which entered our theological tradition through Aquinas and through Augustine, one was free if he were bound. We were bound to the good and the true. Then we talked about equality, and has already been indicated by our discussion preceding our start, the equality may mean equality of opportunity in the sense that everyone, opportunities are open for persons such that one is not discriminated against for external reasons like race or creed or ethnic group, but one is given a chance in terms of his capacity to function. And then a notion has developed recently that it's not only one's capacity to function, but it's the potentiality to function. And so unequal opportunities ought to be given those who for some reason have been denied the opportunity to develop, and hence they don't have the capacities. And hence one thinks in terms of the history of persons and treats them not in terms of some kind of arbitrary equality in terms of their functioning, but in terms of their potentiality for functioning. And then more recently, I think, and certainly in my experience in the freedom movement, we used the notion of equality of results. It wasn't simply in terms of equality of potentiality. Well, that was assumed, and this is very closely related to equality of potentiality, but we assume that if you didn't have black persons in all of the ranges of the roles in a business, there was something wrong, and it was your responsibility to get them there any way you could. And whether or not you could find people that you thought were competent. In other words, you were not judging in terms of the functioning capacity, you're judging in terms of a potentiality to function that may be fairly far down the road. Now that gets into all kinds of problems when you think of what it takes to develop an engineer or what it takes to develop, I was in contracting business, black contracting business, I mean I was a business agent for contractors, and it takes all kinds of time and experience to develop capacities. So that principle really has a lot of trouble. Then the question became, like it was with freedom, whether there isn't an issue involved in equality, that equality is a very formal principle and doesn't have much content unless you push it all the way over to freedom for what, and you deal with truth and goodness. And equality is a very formal concept and doesn't give us much real content unless you ask equality with regard to what? What is worth being equal with regard to? And so you get the same problem. Then we move to the notion of fraternity and discuss the different ways in which fraternity is conceived, and we recognize the problem with that term, but that is the term that we've used. Fraternity has been much less. Brotherhood, perhaps, is a better term, but our hymns are certainly all full of brotherhood and the notion of brotherhood. And our hymns, particularly, that are tied up with our national life, are full of brotherhood. The question is, what's the meaning of that brotherhood? What are the limits to it? What are the grounds for it? And the question which emerged, and I may have been pushing this pretty hard, was whether brotherhood is a gift, that is, it's something which is given us and underlies our being, or it's something which we create. In other words, do we create our relations of affection and concern and care and brotherhood or fraternity by virtue of our experiences with each other? So we develop our families and we become part of each other, and at Holden we develop relations, and we begin to, at least in our experience, continue those relations. Or is it something that is presumed because we are part of the family of God, and so you assume that we are parts of each other, rather than kind of isolated individuals who then get related to each other in ways and develop into relationships, or develop what the sociologists would call a social self. George Herbert means we. And this, again, I think, drives us to ask what it means, kind of at the ultimate, and you might say under God, with regard to our conception of the nature of mankind, or of humanity, how we conceive of humanity. So I think during the week I have been driving us by questions and other ways, trying to elicit answers, to recognize that to be under God would provide us with a particular notion of freedom, equality, and fraternity. And what I'm interested in this morning is exploring further what it would mean to be under God, and for us what it would mean to be in faith with regard to liberty, fraternity, and equality. Now, I asked you, those of you who were here earlier, to read Christian Liberty by Martin Luther. And if you've never read anything much by Luther, and you want to read something, this is only 40 pages, 60 cents. And I really encourage you to do it. This is a treatise that was written to inform the Pope about why Luther felt the Pope was in really was wrong, and the whole Catholic Church was wrong. And you can get the central thrust of Luther. But he's talking about liberty. That's the other thing that's important. Well, what does it mean to be under God in terms of these main concepts? A little problem in thinking about the concepts generally as over against political, but let's let that go by the board for the moment and just think about what it means to be under God with regard to liberty. Freedom.
I think that in a large context in society, that living under God, you would get a very religious sort of connotation, but that's what it would be. God is this great big all-powerful American product. But I think more truly it would be living under a faith, like you said, having God, what he is, and then living in a liberty, trying to live with liberty and equality. And I think you'd have to have a lot, faith would be a major connecting you between the two. Connection.
Faith would make a difference with regard to liberty. The question is, what difference does it make?
What difference?
No doubt, in my mind, it makes a great deal of difference. The fact that it makes a difference isn't as important to me as the difference it makes. I never really hung up on whether somebody else thinks the way I do and he's not a Christian. What interests me is what it means because I'm a Christian. What does our faith say about freedom or liberty?
It probably becomes a much more responsible freedom than a pure freedom of doing what you darn well please, except to the limit of the law. So that theoretically, the law could diminish as the responsible freedom of the individual took over a community, a country, or whatever. And that laws are made because we don't live in responsible freedom. And so there would be much less law in all of society if they were, in fact, living under God as the law, in a sense. So there's much more liberty and much less in the sense of if I accept the responsibility for my freedom and for extending it to others, some of the things that I might be willing to do if I'm not under God are not the same as if I am under God. And I think sometimes in my own viewpoint, using Holden as under God community, I am much more responsibly free than I am on the outside where I figure it's the country's responsibility to keep me in line.
So there'd be less law, and I hear you saying, I'm not sure, but I heard you say, would there be a different attitude toward the law?
Yeah, I think so. If whatever law there is, I'm part of the responsibility for keeping it, extending it, or developing it. And my attitude is one of considering the fraternity, the brotherhood, the equality of another, where the law can't reach it. You can't force equality by, I don't care what the law is or what title it is. And so the attitude towards it would have to be looking at the undergirdings of it for the reality of bringing up equality, for example.
For me, also, it's a matter maybe of attitude because the way, let me take a couple of things. First, my own experience of when I'm in a school, people are giving me rejection all the time. In the school that I was at, I was an authority figure, and I was getting a lot of rejection. And my natural response, and the response I think of seeing so many people, is anger and bitterness. Now, I had that reaction. But I was bound by my reaction. I didn't have any liberty then to go out and love. But through that experience in being with other Christians and working out what had happened and also forgiving myself, living under forgiveness, then the next day being able to love them, not having any bitterness at all. To me, that makes a difference because what I was bound up in, then I'm free. And of course, this isn't always happened, but I just experienced that this last year where I'm free then to come back and love them with Christ's love after being bound up. And the same thing I would think would be with some of the anger of blacks and of the Indians, because I think they have something to tell us about how we've been treating them, and there's justification, but yet as they relate to us, they still have anger and bitterness. And I think coming under the notion of Christian liberty, I think you're somehow not bound by that anger, and then to go out and continue. So that's one notion. I think it's attitude. Christ is a pivotal point for turning our natural negative selves around and then going at it with the right attitude.
I would tend to concur.
that the pivotal point is, you know, in a Christ relationship would be important. If you take the example of Holden, however, look at our attitude in this place. You know, everything is very open, free, loving, everybody smiles. There's no rejection here. It's something that you expect when you come into this kind of environment. But on the other hand, look at how similar we are. We belong to a very, very similar belief structure. Even within the Christian concept, we are extremely similar. How far does this extend as far as not only, you know, within the confines of the village, but outside in the rest of the world, in our reactions with other people who may be very religious in their own right, in their own way, but in a way that's very different from ours? And how does our reaction or their reaction to us occur then? And then my question to you, sir, is the belief of liberty under God, and then different ways of looking at God or a God or several gods. And how does this tie into a way that all of us can coexist in a fraternal brotherhood sense when we believe that the other person may not be right, or we believe that we are right, or we're not sure?
So I think I was speaking from on the outside.
Correct. My question was directed to him. Yeah, from a personal standpoint, I would agree with you very, very closely. But from a societal standpoint,
what is it you agreed with?
Within myself or within the individuals, a Christ-like relationship. If somebody responds to me with anger or hostility or brotherhood or love or suspicion or whatever, my personal relationship with Christ, God, whatever, dictates my response, or enables me to dictate my response in certain ways. But this doesn't apply to other people's, even within my particular religious concept or even outside of that. A lot of our values tend to distort out there. You know, we are Christian, but if somebody burns down our house, you know, we are going to react with anger. Or if someone challenges our belief system, a lot of times we'll respond with hostility or anger. And outside, you put a group of people who all believe in God, but they believe in different ways. From a Jewish standpoint, from an Indian standpoint, from a Catholic standpoint, from a Baptist standpoint, from whatever standpoint, from a Buddhist standpoint that you wish to talk about, and this natural friction, or Ireland, where everyone is theoretically in a Christian community, but the violent disagreement. A Protestant is killed, so let's go out and blow him up.
The question still is what the content is. Greg used the term Christian liberty. What's the content? Or what's the content of your faith to say you can handle these problems? Why can you handle these problems? I'm asking both of you what the content still is of liberty.
What is the force behind it?
In what sense are you free to respond? What's the content of that freedom in terms of which you respond, as over against the way somebody else responds?
Yeah, I think it's obedience.
It's obedience.
I feel in large measure it's security.
It's security.
I think it's obedience to the word.
Obedience to the word. I'm just repeating these phrases so we can think about them. What is the ground of Christian liberty? According to Luther, you've been reading that, Greg.
No, I haven't read that.
Have you? I thought you had. What frees us from the compulsions that just invade us and permeate us in our society? What's the dominant boundness of being an American? We are bound, really bound, personally. I'm thinking about internal freedom right now. I'm using our first term, because I thought that's direction you took it, Greg. How do we become free internally? Luther talks about the distinction between the inner man and the outer man. He spends a lot of time on the inner man. What is it that binds us in America? I think we're bound more in America than almost anywhere else I know. But that, I mean, it's I don't mean to make it American, but we are bound. What are we bound by? Internally. What are we trying to do? What gives meaning for us?
Aren't we trying to protect ourselves?
Protect ourselves. Aspiration. That's, you're warm, I think.
Justice for all.
Justice for all. We're bound by justice for all. Some people would say we're too much bound. Banfield says we're too much bound by our concern for others. But that isn't the dominant thing we're concerned about, is it?
To progress.
To progress. I mean, what is Luther's great doctrine? I'm really trying to get you Lutherans to, being a Baptist, I think maybe I understand Lutherans better than you. What is the great doctrine in Luther?
Justification by
grace through faith, by the act of God through faith. Grace meaning the act of God. Now, probably all of you know that's the doctrine, but what's the meaning of that doctrine in turn? You talked about it, Greg. You said you were free to go back and not regard those rejections. How do rejections function in your life? And you talk about security. What do rejections do? They destroy your sense of worth. They destroy your ego. They cripple you. You curl up inside of you. You become thinking about yourself and how you can get positive responses on the part of other people. And what does Luther say? What does he say? What was his argument about the with the Catholic Church? This is so central. This is the very heart of Lutheranism.
But not practice Lutheranism.
America tells you in every way, shape, and form that you're justified by what you do, by your works, by your achievement, by the external things you have, by what you know, by what you accomplish, by the role you achieve, by the kind of pottery you produce. You're justified if you produce good pottery that people think is good, or good art, or you're a good teacher, or you're a good nurse, or you write good books that sell. You're justified by that. That's what establishes your fundamental worth. And what does Luther say to that? He says, bah, humbug. What justifies you is an act of God in Christ. And there's nothing you can do to achieve your fundamental status as a human being of worth with meaning. You don't have to do anything. You can't do anything. And the harder you try to justify yourself, he says, the more you're going to be a slave, not to God, but to yourself. That's what he said.
Can't get into the kingdom by playing volleyball.
That's right. And he says that, he says in this, a Christian is
perfect. By grace I can.
A Christian is perfectly free, Lord of all, subject to none. And a Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. But the difference is the reason you're a servant. You can't by loving other people or trying to love them, if you're loving them because you think you've got to love them, you can't love them, Luther says. You will not be able to do anything good for your neighbor if you do it in order to prove yourself a lover. to justify yourself. I think that's tremendously important. Tremendously important. There's no way you can earn your salvation. He'll turn right around and say, if you're a Christian, you do good works. And you love your neighbor. You're obedient, you see. When you talk about obedience, obedience follows freely. He'll turn right around and say, if you're a Christian, you do good works. And you love your neighbor. So if you're a slave, you're obedient, you see. When you talk about obedience, obedience follows freely. It follows because if this gift has been given to you, if Christ has become a part of your life, and hence you identify with him and everything that was his being is your being, then you no longer have to do anything, you know, to reestablish a relationship with God. You are in God's eyes what you ought to be through Christ. And therefore, you don't have to become anything. You don't have to become anything in order to be. And once you can get over that hump, then you're free to be. And if you don't get over that hump, you will destroy yourself and other people. Because you'll always be trying to do it in order to prove yourself good or knowledgeable or virtuous. You'll be trying to prove it. So you've got to succeed. Why can you be vulnerable, Larry? Why can you be vulnerable? You can be vulnerable because you know you don't have to be invulnerable in order for God to love you and take you in his arms and bring you into the fullness of his being. You don't have to do that. There's nothing you have to do when you know it. You really know that. That permits you to admit to your children that you're a louse. That you hit them and you shouldn't have hit them. You lost your temper and you shouldn't have lost your temper, but you did it. And you did it. But you can admit it, right? So there's a freedom. This is the door to internal freedom. Now, I don't know what you do about problems that are related to psychological compulsion and how Luther would have handled all our psychotherapy in terms of whether or not this kind of faith is going to free a person who's got some very, very deep unconscious resentment and history. So you might have to add, you've got to think at least about the relationship of faith, which is the doctrine of the whole being, with that which is wrapped up with your own personal psyche. And I'm not intending this morning to get into those problems. They're very deep problems and things we need to think about. But one of the problems in psychotherapy is that if you deal with some compulsion and you don't get to the place where the person accepts himself finally and feels accepted ultimately, the person will go right back into the same kind of a situation. That is, the psychologist is not going to give you faith except accidentally. That is, he is not going to provide you with a sense of acceptance except accidentally, that is of ultimate acceptance. He may function in an accepting way, and therefore he acts as a Christ to you. Really acts. That's one of the great values of psychotherapy, because the psychotherapist just accepts you in spite of what you are. He listens to you, and he doesn't raise his, you know, blink and go shudder and the way parents do and I do about what people do and so forth. There's a complete acceptance. The question is how you can mediate that ultimate acceptance. Well, now the question is, what do you do with your freedom, in this kind of freedom? See, this is a kind of freedom that transcends the political freedom. It's the ground for any political freedom. And as John said, if you have this kind of freedom, then you might voluntarily obey the law. At least you'll be able to recognize what's going on in society and not have to prove yourself. I have terrible trouble driving. I don't know what I'm trying to prove when somebody gets in front of me and beats me out or something. I don't know what I'm trying to prove, but I gotta beat him out. You know, I don't know. I gotta
I say I've got to kind of punish him, or kind of, I get all upset. I don't know what I'm trying to prove, whether our car will pick up faster or what. But, so there's a sense in which our personalities are functioning in these situations. You might be freer to do what's required in situations instead of responding with kind of compulsions to be better and to prove yourself. And the question then is, what's the content of the freedom under God? And Luther says it is to love one's neighbor. First you love yourself, you've got a lot of things, but let's take loving the neighbor. It is to love the neighbor. It is really to be concerned with the neighbor's good. After you take care of a few needs of your own, it is to do what the neighbor needs. And so in your freedom, you are doing what the neighbor needs. You are Christ to the other. And the question then, what does it mean to serve the neighbor under God? What does it mean to serve the neighbor under God? What's the content of that? What do we do? It's very clear in Luther that we would be serving the neighbor. We would not be thinking about our careers. We would not be thinking about the development of ourselves. We would be thinking about the neighbor's needs, and everybody is the neighbor. So you'd be thinking about humanity's needs. Now, what do you do in your freedom then? You're now bound to your neighbor. So your freedom is not freedom to do as you please. I think we all recognize that. It's not a freedom from responsibility. It's a freedom being justified by grace now for the neighbor, to really be present for the neighbor and not in order to serve ourselves. We are not present for the neighbor in order to serve ourselves. We are present for the neighbor in terms of the neighbor's needs.
Well, in terms of Brad's discussion, I think he explains that by, rather than the rejection or the hate or whatever he had as the authoritarian figure, through the God concept, that he then was able to love them back. So it seems to me that would be a practical illustration of how.
Right. He is free to love them back, but what's the content of his love for them?
Well, whatever is then needed in the content.
And how do you determine what is needed?
Well, he obviously determined that love, just to love them back and not reject them, or to be bitter against them for whatever it is he needed to give them.
Acceptance, I think, is what we all need. I think the content.
And then he would go from the acceptance and of how whatever his vocation was or whatever he's doing to help them be better selves.
I hate to use a volleyball term, but then if a person needs to develop his skills, do you play in a game where the person develops the skills, or do you play in a game with people who are skilled? I mean, it's very concrete.
Okay, so if I want to be, sometimes I'm for the other guy on that volleyball court and I'll play with anybody in any way. Some days it's for me, and then I'm not helping my neighbor, I'm enjoying my own and helping those other ones who are also skilled to enjoy theirs. Some of the time I'm there as a policeman for Carol, as an example, and it's not my particular day or need. Some days it's for some other group to really enjoy it by having, say, highly skilled. Some other day it's for, I'll move to that court over there, which is strictly for those that want to just have fun, but also want that ball to go over the net occasionally on it. So I think it's all of these.
Luther has a nice principle, but it still doesn't help us completely. He says we do what the neighbor wants us to do, as long as what he asks is nothing contrary to God. That's a nice principle. But then you've got the problem still of what is contrary to God. that is, the question is, what is our neighbor asking us to do? And of course, the prime example is the masochist who wants you to beat him. And then do you beat him? Because that's what he wants you to do. And so it does involve some notion. But I think it drives us eventually to some notion of what is good for people. You could say, well, what it does is take you to do what the neighbor asks you to do, but then you've got this contrary to God. And at least for me, the problem is, do you then have to have a notion of what is good for a person?
Well, I would think you would.
In order to know whether it's contrary to God. In other words, freedom, in this sense, finally drives you to some notion of what the content of the image of God in man is. What the content of that is. What it means to be human. And that's not a simple task. In our vocations, frequently, we find ourselves doing things which are asked of us by a corporation or by a school. And you could say, well, if you're a Christian, you're free to do that. You're free to do what is asked of you. And frequently you find, that's what Luther is saying, that if you're a barmaid, a milkmaid, you do a good job in your task in accordance with the way the role is set up. But I have a lot of trouble in our society. I would find it very difficult to be in the Chrysler Corporation today producing those big cars. In General Motors, although they're moving towards small cars, I'd be finding it very difficult to do a good job in a corporation like that. You should be free to do what is needed and what is required by the society. But the question is then, what is the society requiring of you? So that under God, for me, means first, that one is free from needing to justify himself. Second, that one is free for the neighbor. One becomes a Christ to the neighbor. One becomes a servant. Those are all terms that Luther uses for the neighbor. And third, one has to ask the question of what is the content of it. Same question we had in equality. One is free to ask that what is available for one is available for the other, if he wants it. But the question again is, what is available? Does it mean that one is a neighbor to the people of the United States by participating in the great growth in our material civilization? Or does one have some other notion of what it means to be under God? If your culture, if your society is moving in what you consider to be a healthy direction, then to serve the neighbor really is the content of that is given to you by your society. If you have real questions about that, and your neighbor is socialized in a culture which requires the kind of material foundation that ours does, then you have a real question of how you serve your neighbor. Do you serve your neighbor by participation in the production of all the things? Or is that really a disservice to your neighbor? And of course, if we go to the third term, the term of fraternity, and we begin to ask who is in the fraternity, and we talk about the neighbor being mankind, then we have all the future generations, and we have all the rest of the people in the world to ask about. And that becomes quite a task, in putting that all under God.
It seems like, I'm still in tension with this, you know, it seems like God uses people wherever they're at, even the guy in the Chrysler Corporation. If that guy is responding to Christ and is set free, he is in some sense set free to be a Christ to the people there and in making a decision. But maybe he doesn't have a full, maybe he doesn't have a greater picture of, he doesn't have the full content, you know. And then, you know, then another person has a greater picture of what it means to be good.
What if he thinks that building those cars and using up God's resources and taking away from his neighbors, and in the future there won't be any resources for the neighbor?
I think he has to respond to his conscience. Or,
now, Luther talks about a kind of a free response. And then the question is, do we respond kind of spontaneously, or do we have to think it's not to justify yourself, but it's if you're going to love your neighbor, you have to do what is good for the neighbor, and who knows what is good for the neighbor.
But he's also going to be set up in that conflict situation. Even if he believes that, he can still continue to work there. If he has a sick daughter who needs a heart operation, he's going to need the money. In much the same way, is that he says, even though I know what I'm about to do is wrong, he goes ahead and whacks the kid anyway. There's still, you know, as long as you have the fundamental freedom, you can still have the conflict situation and be able to function within it.
I was thinking how the rest of people feel. This should be our discussion, not a discussion of me at this point. This is a gathered church, and I'm not the Pope. Luther believes that Christ is in every one, and together we formulate this understanding. I think I've introduced you to the problem and to a little of Luther's thinking. I think that's about as much responsibility as I have.
What frustrates me is that in my picture of society right now, in every place you go there, you're going to be doing wrong, you know. I mean, you'll be acting out a wrong, I feel. You know, if you're in a school system and somehow you have a better concept of what is good, well, then if you stick in the school system, well, then you're carrying on maybe some practices of the structure that you feel are not part of the content. You know, and it seems like everywhere you go, you have that. So is it a matter of degree of where you decide to be to carry out the content? You know, or are you... I don't know if this is where everybody else wants to go. So I want you to tell me to shut up. I mean, that's to me, if you act out content, well, where do you act that out? And what is your relationship then to structure?
Isn't the question whether you can act out your content within the structure or you can't?
Sometimes I don't think you can.
Yeah, and if you can't, then I think you have to find a structure that you can.
But that's relative. Sometimes you can act part of your content out and you can't act some other part. It's not a matter of either or. It seems, you know, it's...
But it's an either or in your priorities of life. If you can or you can't. Yeah, right. But if it becomes so black that you... Yeah, but then in this case, your frustration, if you've made a decision to do it. His question was, what is the decision that you make? Whether you work in it or not work in it, wasn't it? Well, I know, but your very decision is still a decision.
Yeah.
And then you work within that decision.
And always knowing that it might be a wrong decision and being able to cope with the fact that you might have made that wrong decision and been offended. Because you've got... You'd be afraid to act ever. You're always worried that it's going to be the right decision. to make the decision, and you work with it as long as you feel that this is the best way to do it. But you can also say, because you might open it because what you thought was best at the time, but you can also, you're free and you're wrong. You just got to hunt. I moved. Yeah. And then you're free to change and make another decision. Yeah. I think
so that's clear, isn't it? That you're not going to be justified by making the right decision. That's the kind of freedom. You have the freedom to be wrong, and you have the freedom to live in a situation which seems very, very ambiguous. You have the freedom because you're not proving yourself. So I think there are no unambiguous situations. So it's a question of relative ambiguity. So it's clear you're free. Then the question is whether Lutherans have frequently said, well, and really taken seriously, you are free. You're not justified by doing the good in the situation, so you're free to sin boldly. But the question is whether Luther doesn't say that then you're free to love the neighbor and serve the neighbor, and whether or not you can assume that that service is understood and that spontaneously in your freedom you're going to know what it is without the Christian community gathering to think about what that service really means. And I guess it's at that point that I'm trying to push you as to whether to be under God doesn't push us beyond justification by grace, beyond the spontaneous response of the person who is in Christ, and Christ is in him, and therefore he is loving, he is moving out toward the neighbor, whether it doesn't move us to reason together, the words of Isaiah, and consider what it means to be under God in terms of the content of love. My own thinking is that it's much more difficult to love today. Maybe that's not true, and it's been in other times. Because I think the ordinary institutions of our culture are much more ambiguous. And you have to ask this question, what it means to be under God with an energy crisis. What it means to be under God? Does it mean we drive out the Holden the way we did with a big car, or whether we take the train? What does it mean to be under God? And you can't choose the right, certainly not in terms of justification, but there's some choices that seem to embody being under God more than others.
Yes, but it's very healthy to have the question, even if everything is in a state of complete anonymity, as long as people are asking the question, it's very healthy, I feel.
We're not in a state of complete enemies. It's a sense in which maybe we are more than I think we are. I think our national life is driving ahead pretty much in terms of trying to discover more energy and reduce it a little, but the important thing is to get the road on the show on the road and get our GNP climbing again.
Much more so in the national sense than 10 years ago. 10 years ago, people were asking even more vehemently, which way? So answers are produced, and if they're wrong, then we switch and we try something else.
Maybe it's too big a question to ask to be on what it means to love concretely. It's just too big a question for us. We have to deal with concrete things more. That to be under God, it means we have to ask what we do about energy, and what we do about education, and what we do about a whole lot of things very concrete, as over against thinking we can get a general answer. I'm very skeptical of great big general principles. I mean, we have to kind of say, what does it mean to be under God in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago, where I'm at? As over against what does it mean generally. And so you each have to take your own positions and ask that.
It seems like we have to consider using the other fields, you know, our spiritual needs of people, the psychological needs of people, and the environmental needs of people. It seems like we just have to go right back to all the different roles and find out what people need.
See, our national life is kind of assumed you don't have to ask this question. Or if it's asked, it's a personal question. It's not a public question. Our national life is assumed that we don't ask these big questions nationally for the most part. That the questions of the ultimate meanings and visions of what is good are personal, private. And the national government is kind of to provide the framework for that. And nationally, we do not have a public debate, really, about what the purpose of this nation is. We do not have a continuing debate about that, I think. I may be wrong, but I just don't see. And many people will affirm that that's not the purpose, that that's not the way that we ought to conceive of the national life. We ought to conceive of the national life as somehow providing a framework for us to do what we personally, privately, maybe collectively in certain groups, decide what to do. It would be another way of asking a question, tying it in with the political and the meaning of this week. Should there be a public debate about what it means to be under God, the underlying direction of American life, about the values which are being actualized in America today, and the relation of those values to the rest of the world, to humanity, to the future. Is that a necessary part of our national life? Or can we just relegate that to the private?